Everybody, how are you doing? I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. And I'm really grateful to be doing this show. You know, it's been 6.5 years. I can't believe time flies. And it's just been an amazing ride doing this program. And I put a shout out to everybody at Progressive Radio Network for the great job that they're doing and for giving me an opportunity to be able to speak once a week about things that I am very passionate about. You know, it's funny, it seems like whenever I start talking about food on this program, I hear a little theme song outdoors. It's not my theme song, but maybe it should be. It's that Mr. Softy truck. How is it? Without fail, it always seems to play at opportune moments. Anyway, I look forward to one day when the Mr. Softy truck can offer all plant-based delicious frozen treats and nothing else. So every time I hear that song, that's what I think about. So it's been a little cooler these days, and I'm really grateful for that. I wanted to mention it's important to be mindful and think about what you're doing every moment and what you're saying. And I realized when it was so hot that I was using the word oppressive and saying that the heat was so oppressive. And then it dawned on me, I have no idea what oppression is. I lead a very good life. I have a lot of privilege. I have good food to eat. I am free. And I don't have a clue what oppression is. And so I don't think that's really a good adjective to use when I'm talking about really hot heat. And it made me think about all the opportunities I have. So when it's really hot, I can take a cool shower and cool off. I can turn on the air conditioner, which I really don't like to use, but I do use it when it's really, really hot and I need to just think. And I'm grateful for that. And just changing that thought from freedom made the heat a lot more bearable. Okay, and I also wanted to mention, this is a difficult one, but perhaps you heard this, Steve Meyerowitz, the Sprout Man. I had him on this program 3 times, and he was killed in a car accident on Wednesday night, and I did not know him very well. I loved talking to him on this program. I loved his energy, which popped out of the screen, popped out of my speakers. He was just so passionate, so alive, and full of wonderful information. And it just surprises me how sad I am to know that he's gone. So if you remember the Sprout Man or you don't, you can visit responsibleeatingandliving.com. I have a little post about him, and you can link and read about him, hear some of his interviews, and keep his message and his voice alive. Steve, we miss you. All right, let's get to the good part of the program. I'm going to bring on my first guest, Bruce Friedrich. He's Farm Sanctuary's Director of Policy and Engagement, oversees Farm Sanctuary's work on legislation, litigation, policy, and engagement. Before joining Farm Sanctuary, Bruce worked for 2 years as a public school teacher in inner city Baltimore, where he was his school's teacher of the year, for 6 years as a homeless shelter and soup kitchen in Washington, D.C., and for 15 years at PETA, People for Ethical Treatment of Animals, where he was vice president for campaigns. He's a popular speaker on issues of animal rights and effective advocacy. He has appeared many times on CNN, Fox News, and MSNBC, and is a regular contributor to the Huffington Post. And I just want to say that I am very happy and privileged to have a moment to speak with Bruce Friedrich, who is, as you soon will see if you don't know already, is very articulate, very full of love, a very humble and wonderful person. And I'm glad I get to share the planet with you. Welcome to It's All About Food, Bruce.
Hey, Karen, thank you so much for having me on, and I'm glad that I get to share the planet with you.
Yeah, you and me and 7 billion others. But it's a good moment to be here, and I like to think that even though we're hearing about so much violence in the world today, that there's a lot of good things that we're not hearing about or not hearing enough about. And the last time I spoke with you was back in 2011. You had just joined Farm Sanctuary. So the first thing I want to know is, what's new?
Oh, what's new is a really big question. We continue to work away on a wide variety of projects. I guess the two that I'm most excited about are the Massachusetts Ballot Initiative. I was just in Massachusetts this past weekend speaking and gathering signatures. We will be putting on the ballot in Massachusetts an initiative that will ban the worst confinement systems for farm animals, so veal crates and gestation crates, which keep baby calves and pregnant pigs in crates that are basically the size of their bodies. The animals literally cannot turn around for their entire lives. And battery cages for egg-laying hens, which are similar to veal and gestation crates, except that they keep five hens on average in a space about the size of a file drawer. So these three confinement systems are really the trifecta of factory farming abuse, and we're planning to make both the systems themselves illegal in the state of Massachusetts, as well as the sale of products from these systems illegal in the state of Massachusetts. And I had a great time this weekend gathering signatures with volunteers from the Humane League and the Massachusetts SPCA, the ASPCA, the Humane Society of the United States. And people are excited about it. People on the ground, Massachusetts citizens, appear to be universally opposed to these sorts of systems. So I'm very optimistic about making them illegal. So that's one of the things that's up.
This is just in the state of Massachusetts. Are there other states that have already banned these things?
Florida has banned gestation crates. Arizona banned gestation crates. California banned gestation crates and veal crates and battery cages. That was all. Those three states banned those systems by popular vote. And then there are half a dozen additional state legislatures that have banned, you know, one or more of these three systems. Really big news, the Humane Society of the United States scored a colossal victory when they convinced McDonald's to phase out battery cages from their supply chain over the next 10 years. And the industry itself in the last couple of days has been editorializing that that's really the beginning of the end of battery cages. So those are the cages about the size of a file drawer. They confine about five hens on average, although oftentimes it's actually seven or eight hens in the cages if the cages are being used for liquid eggs. And the level of abuse is the same as if you put five or seven dogs or cats into tiny wire mesh cages. The cages stack one on top of the other for their entire lives. The animal's muscles and bones deteriorate from their complete lack of mobility. When they're pulled out of the cages in the best case conditions, a third of them suffer new bone breaks because their muscles and bones have so deteriorated from not being used for years on end. And then chickens actually outperform dogs and cats on tests of behavioral, emotional, and cognitive sophistication. So just like a dog or a cat would, if they were unable to move for years on end, the animals go completely insane. These things are torture chambers. And if we'd had this conversation just a week ago, I would not have been able to say that they are being relegated to the dustbin of history right now as we're talking.
Oh, well, that is good news. Just hearing you say all of those things about how the animals are treated. I know these things, and yet every time someone describes them, it's very difficult to hear. So this is a good thing, even though it's going to take some time to phase this out. And instead, the chickens still aren't going to be in paradise. They're still going to be confined, but it's not going to be as bad.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. Unfortunately, cage-free does not even begin to approximate cruelty-free. So if you look at these cage-free facilities, they are filthy. The animals don't go outside. The animals are breathing ammonia-laden air. It's bad conditions, but when you compare cage-free to cages, I mean, the animals are going from really complete immobility for years on end to squalid but at least able to move around. So the solution, obviously, is for everybody to stop eating animal products altogether. But on the way to that, for the hundreds of millions of animals who are currently in tiny little cages, getting out of those cages does make a meaningful difference for them. I did just want to backtrack. You mentioned how hard it is to hear these conditions explained, and I could not agree more. I do think for people who consume these products, we owe it to ourselves, if we're consuming these products, to actually know what it is that we're supporting. And so I would encourage people to check out a video that we put together at Farm Sanctuary. It's called What Came Before? And it introduces you to three farm sanctuary animals and then shows you what their lives would have been like if they were not in sanctuary at Farm Sanctuary. And it's just whatcamebefore.com online. So www.whatcamebefore.com. It's about 10 minutes, and it's really quite eye-opening.
Okay, what came before? It doesn't take much, but I know that a lot of people feel like they're doing something good when they buy a box of eggs that says free range, for example, not even knowing what it means.
I mean, you know, free range doesn't have any kind of legal requirement behind it. The vast majority of free range eggs are certainly not as bad as eggs that are not labeled free range, but there have been multiple exposés into the conditions for free-range hens, and they are far short of the bucolic image that is oftentimes on the carton and that probably most people get in their mind's eye when they think free-range. So I would challenge people who are interested in buying eggs and they want to buy free-range eggs. You know, it's the whole sort of know-your-farmer concept. I would challenge people to go find the hens and ask to see the conditions that they're raised in. And my hunch is that people will be very unpleasantly surprised by what free range looks like. So, you know, is it a meaningful improvement over cages, which is how 90% of egg-laying hens are housed? Yes, probably in every instance or just about every instance, it's a meaningful improvement over cages. Is it good conditions? No, it is probably still conditions that would be prosecutable as cruelty if these were protected animals, if these were dogs or cats.
Bruce, you suggest people get to know their farmers and where their eggs come from. That's too much trouble. People don't want to do that. They want easy and convenient.
Well, it's new, and you have to learn new habits in order to stop eating animal products altogether, but once you've been doing it for a little bit, it becomes easy and convenient. So, I mean, I think one of the things about basic integrity is, Socrates said, the unexamined life is not worth living. So examining our lives and with regard to our food choices, examining where our food comes from, if people can't go to the inconvenience of visiting the farm, then perhaps those aren't products that we should be consuming at all.
Enjoying, and that's a sarcastic enjoying term, what's going on between Hampton Foods' Just Mayo product and the American Egg Board that's been getting a lot of press for kind of going or doing some things that may come out as illegal, actually, and all the trouble that they're going to try and squash this new company, which makes a mayonnaise-like product that looks, tastes, feels like the traditional egg product, but it doesn't contain an animal egg. It contains plant eggs.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. I mean, for people who aren't familiar with the controversy, the American Egg Board is a quasi-governmental agency. The members of the American Egg Board are appointed by the United States Secretary of Agriculture. The government is not supposed to be in a situation in which it is attacking American companies, and yet some emails that were obtained through Freedom of Information Act requests document very clearly that the American Egg Board is working with public relations agencies to attack Hampton Creek Foods, to basically bury a competing product in what looks to me like violation of the law. And there are some pretty startling emails in this correspondence, including emails where members of the American Egg Board are joking about actually killing the CEO of Hampton Creek Foods. It really is quite remarkable.
It is quite remarkable indeed. Okay, so you're in Washington, D.C.?
I am.
And you get to, what's it like in a day in the life of Bruce Friedrich? What I'm leading to is your interaction with some of our representatives and what it's like to interact with them and the feedback that you get, because we're all very frustrated with our government right now and how dysfunctional it is and how bipartisan it is and how it seems like nothing is getting done. So how does it work for you?
Well, I work with agencies, with the USDA, more than I work with members of Congress. I have had some very promising meetings with Cory Booker's staff, and he's talking about getting Dianne Feinstein's staff involved as well with regard to some regulatory work that I'm doing having to do with the Humane Methods of Slaughter Act and the degree to which that is just grotesquely under-enforced by the USDA. But at the legislative level, I think you've really hit on it. The partisanship is really unprecedented. And passing laws that help farm animals through the federal government was already a borderline impossible slog, because everything that would help farm animals would have to get through the House and Senate agricultural committees. And even under the best of times, those committees are dominated by the people who are most invested and most interested in agriculture, and that oftentimes means animal agriculture. So even where you would have a majority of members of both houses of Congress, you need to first get a majority of both the House and the Senate agricultural committees to get bills to the floor. And that has not happened in probably more than 15 years with regard to farm animal protection legislation. And when it did last happen with farm animal protection legislation, something happened that I didn't even know was possible. A bill passed the House and the Senate that would have banned the slaughter of downed cattle. And this was before that was banned through regulation in late 2003 and then, you know, re-solidified and improved in 2009. This was roughly 1999 or 2000. And it passed with the ban on the slaughter of downed cattle, and it was taken out in conference committee. So wording that had made it through both the House and the Senate floors was taken out before the bill was sent to the president for his signature, which I think gives you a sense of the power of big agriculture in Congress. So we work primarily through state legislatures and state ballot initiatives, as well as through regulatory reform, which involves taking the laws that already exist, for example, the Humane Methods of Slaughter Act and the Poultry Products Inspection Act, and trying to put some additional teeth into them. And in the case of both those laws, unfortunately, they're borderline toothless as a result of the USDA's lack of enforcement of them. The laws on the books could be quite meaningful for animals in the final moments of their lives, and we're trying to align what the laws say with the actual enforcement of them.
The USDA has a lot of problems, and I hope to see it improve over time, because, number one, it's got a conflict of interest with itself, where it's supposed to be promoting health and nutrition and healthy foods, and at the same time, it's promoting its agricultural products. So when it tells you that cheese with high saturated fat isn't healthy for you, then they also at the same time promote eating more cheese. And this is a serious issue, and I don't even know how they do it. And clearly they don't do it well. And then the other problem is they're not funded really to enforce the important regulations that we already have.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually even sort of a little bit more nefarious than that on the humane slaughter front, because they actually do have, USDA has the money allocated by Congress to do a significantly better job of enforcement than they do. And because USDA just appears not to care that much about the Humane Slaughter Act, they don't even spend the money that's allocated to them, and they don't do what Congress has mandated that they do. There's a degree to which Congress's lack of oversight is also a problem, but you would expect if Congress passes a law and funds the law and creates a mandate for an agency to just basically say, nah, we're not going to do that. I mean, that's the situation that we find ourselves in, and it's something that is taking an awful lot of my time, and that's one of the things that I'm trying to rectify.
Okay, well, we're glad that we've got you doing that, because there's nobody better out there that can make it happen. I'm behind
you. Very kind
of you.
Thank you very much,
Bruce. Okay, so what are some of the fun things that are going on with you in Farm Sanctuary? Let's lighten it up and hear some of the lovelier side.
Well, the Massachusetts stuff is pretty lovely. Anybody who wants to volunteer for a week or two, the Humane Society of the United States has rented a house in Boston, and they provide the housing and they provide the food, and it's a lot of fun and camaraderie and other really good stuff. So that's pretty cool. We had our hoedown last month. We have the hoedown in the first or second week of August every year. It's a big party. 250 people come together. We have our big gala honoring John and Tracy Stewart, both of whom are going to be there in New York City next month. Senator Cory Booker from New Jersey is going to be there presenting John and Tracy Stewart with the Humanitarian Award, so that's an awful lot of fun. We published our Someone Project is running strong. We published papers on the complex emotional behavioral and cognitive lives of fish and pigs, and are just submitting our chicken paper to the Journal of Animal Cognition. So lots of fun, interesting things, and people can check out all of it online at farmsanctuary.org. That's just farmsanctuary.org. And we love visitors, and the animals love visitors. So if somebody, upstate New York is a really nice place to visit. Lots of wineries, lots of great hiking, and farm sanctuaries there in Watkins Glen. So if anybody is anywhere near the area, I certainly would invite them to come and take a tour and meet the animals when you're doing other fun stuff up there.
As we go into the fall season, it's, in my opinion, the best time to visit upstate New York. My favorite time and my favorite place.
Yeah, really beautiful.
Can you just give us a little taste of what is in the behavioral study with fish, cognitive behavioral study you were just mentioned?
Sure. So fish have long-term memories, so they remember other fish for at least 2 years, the faces of other fish. I don't know about you, but I can't do that with human beings. But fish can do it with one another. They remember if they've been netted and released in a certain spot. They have the capacity to remember where it was that they were netted and released. A fish school is an awful lot like a pack of wolves. So when the scientists are looking at the complexity of the behavioral relationships of fish, there is the alpha fish and who sort of runs the pack, and they have complex interactions and mating rituals. We actually, with regard to all of the ethological work, ethology is just the study of emotion, behavior, and cognition in animals. With regard to all of the ethological work that's been done across species, it's pretty nascent in fish and farm animals relative to great apes and cetaceans and elephants and dogs. But what exists is extraordinarily intriguing, and we have it distilled in the education section of our website. So if you go to farmsanctuary.org, in the top navigation, you'll see education. If you hover there, you'll see someone, not something, and you can click on that and see a species-by-species distillation of all of the interesting stuff that scientists have discovered about farm animals.
I think at this point I'm most fascinated to learn about fish just because I know land animals feel and think and love and want to be with their families and pursue their lives and their freedom. It's easier to relate to mammals because we're mammals, and it gets more difficult to really empathize with other living species that don't look anything like us, especially don't even live in the same environment, living underwater. But I know that there's so much going on there, and just one of the reasons I won't eat them. Fish are your friends, not food. That's my favorite line from the movie Finding Nemo. I say it a lot.
Yeah, so Sylvia Earle is probably the foremost living marine biologist. I think if she were male, she would be as well known as Jacques Cousteau. Mm-hmm. And she talks about the complex emotions and cognition of fish. And she had a really great line. She said, fish are interesting. They're individuals. I'd no more eat a fish than I'd eat a cocker spaniel. Because in some areas, fish outperform dogs on some of these tests. And I would encourage people to check out the fish section of our Someone Project website. It's just titled Meet the Animals Fish. And you can either get there through farmsanctuary.org. I think the navigation is pretty intuitive. Or you could just Google Meet the Animals Fish, and it'll pop right up.
Wonderful. There's a lot of great information at the Farm Sanctuary website, no question. Farm Sanctuary has been at this for a long, long time, and the information just becomes more fascinating and compelling. We just have a few more minutes left, and I just want to say, Bruce, I haven't seen you in a while, but in your pictures, you're looking fit and fabulous, as ever.
Oh, that's so nice of you, Karen, and absolutely the same about you. As I was getting ready for this interview, I was sort of surfing around, and you haven't changed at all in the last 15 years. So,
thank you.
Yeah, you look great.
Well, first of all, I'm alive, and I'm grateful to be alive. You know, there was a moment there in my life where it was questionable, but I'm over that hump, and I'm grateful for that. But I think we're not getting older. We're getting better. Now, you're a big runner, right?
I'm not. I kind of trashed my knees. So now I was a big runner, and now I'm a big bicyclist. So I ride my bike generally 15 or 20 miles a day, because when I go out for anything approximating a long run, I'm hobbling for a couple of days afterwards. But it seems like I can ride my bike indefinitely without any knee pain at all. So I don't know what the deal is there, but I've gone from running to biking.
Okay. I'm sorry to hear about your knees, but, you know, that's this thing about human, you know, we are vulnerable no matter what we do. And the other thing I wanted to know is what you're eating these days.
What am I eating these days? So I had, chickpeas and rice and fried kale for lunch with my wife, Alka, who is a phenomenal cook. So that's what I had for lunch. For breakfast, we had smoothies and potato pancakes.
Oh, nice. That sounds pretty good. I did want to ask you about Dr. Alka Chandler and see how she was doing. So I'm glad you mentioned her. And I love the work that she's doing at PETA as well. Give her a hug for me.
I definitely will. And she sends hugs back to you, Karen.
Very good. Well, Bruce, it's just been a delight to have you on and hear all the wonderful things that you're up to. And I know you're going to continue and do even more. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Karen, and thank you for your lovely radio program and inviting me on to be a part of it. I really appreciate it, and I hope our paths will cross in person very soon.
Yes, I do. I hope that. Okay, take care. Lots of love.
All right, thanks. You too.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Woo! All right, that was the amazing Bruce Friedrich, and as he was mentioning all the different resources you can discover at Farm Sanctuary, I really hope that you check some of them out, especially if, you know, you're discussing with other people who aren't as open and receptive about this idea about eating plants. A lot of great information there will help you fuel your conversation. I don't want to say argument because I want to keep it positive and light, but it's good to have a lot of information at your fingertips so you're confident about what you're talking about. And, you know, as we learn that fish are your friends and not food, sometimes it helps to have these cognitive behavior studies at your fingertips. All right, let's just take a very brief break and I'll be back with my next guest. Everybody, we're back. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. And what'd you think of that song? I've been listening to that song as the intro to my show now for 6.5 years. And I don't always get to hear much of it because we just play the beginning of it. But I really enjoy it. I hope you enjoyed that moment. I did. I want to tell you, my brother wrote and performed that piece, Barry Hartglass. You could find out more about him and his work at barryhartglass.com. But I never tire of that little bit of music, so I just had a fun little moment there. I hope you did too. Did you hear the bass? That's my favorite part. Let's move on to the second part of the program. I want to bring on my next guest, Elise J. Lane, who's the author of a new book, Nonviolence Now, Living the 1963 Birmingham Campaign's Promise of Peace. Elise is a former professor who taught African American literature and culture at UC Santa Barbara. She is author of Coming In From the Cold, a blog in which she analyzes political and social issues through the prism of Martin Luther King Jr.'s philosophy of nonviolence. A student of engaged Buddhism, Elise, in 2012, participated in the year-long Commit to Dharma course offered by the East Bay Meditation Center under the tutelage of Larry Yang. She earned her Bachelor of Arts from Howard University, Doctorate of Philosophy from UCLA, and Juris Doctor from UC Berkeley. She currently lives in Oakland. Welcome to It's All About Food.
Karen, how are you doing? Thank you so much for having me on.
Now, how do you pronounce your first name? I don't know if I was saying it right.
You were close. It's Elise, so it's a long A. And so the two E's are silent. I don't know why my mother did that, but, you know, it's my name. What am I going to do?
Yeah, she wanted to give you more, so she gave you an extra E for bonus. Elise.
An extra bit of silence, one could say.
Yeah, I like it. Why not? Hey, you know, this world, it's all as we make it, and we make it up as we go along. Now, the key is to make it more peaceful than we've been doing. That's the trick.
Absolutely. I agree with you 100%, and that's one of the reasons I wrote my book.
It's not easy. It's not easy to act nonviolently, and you go in great detail in your book, kind of giving us a template with history and ideas and quotes and stories to help us do that. Thank you.
Yes.
<You're welcome>. Okay. Now let's just start with the beginning. Your title, the Birmingham Campaign's Promise of Peace. Now, can we just go back to that 1963 event? Because, you know, I hate to admit it, but when I was in public school, I don't remember learning about this.
No. Not one of those things you learn in public school. And in fact, you learn very little African-American history and American history, for that matter, in public schools. It was a pivotal event in the civil rights movement. The first time that children were deployed on the front lines of the struggle. And it made all the difference in the world because people got to see for their own eyes on television the kind of brutality that African-Americans faced in the South. And for many people to see children hosed down and have dogs sicked upon them made all the difference in the world in terms of their support for changes in civil rights and in terms of how in terms of dismantling Jim Crow in the South. So it was a very important event. So it actually lasted for quite a few months. So there were different actions during the course of the months. Ultimately, it was one of the things that compelled President Johnson to act in terms of legislation, voting rights, and so forth. It wasn't the pivotal thing in that regard, but it was one of the many things that gave him some sort of impetus to move forward.
Now, you're promoting nonviolence in terms of when injustice occurs. The reaction shouldn't be an eye for an eye, a tooth for tooth, and getting violent. Instead, it should be resisting and not reacting in a violent way. That's a very hard and a tall order.
Well, I think nonviolence, you know, Martin Luther King put it in, I think, beautiful terms. And when he said that, you know, to speak of self-defense or these kinds of things in the context of nonviolence makes about as much sense as asking a soldier who's at war to sort of not put himself in harm's way. The point is to put oneself on the line and to what King called engage in redemptive suffering. That is to say that one steps forward and is willing to suffer in order to change the system and willing to suffer for others. So yes, it's a huge decision because it requires you to confront your fear of death, your fear of bodily harm, and to ask yourself, you know, how committed are you to undoing injustice? But you know, it's not just a matter of promoting it in terms of confronting systems. What I try to argue in my book is that, you know, we've done just a piece of nonviolence. What it really requires of us is that we change the way we live. And so to sort of to come back to that place where it's like, well, you know, it's a way of life and it's a political imperative.
We have to make a lot of changes. There's so many things that are wrong with our system, and you know, I'd like to think that we can work within it, but sometimes I think we just got to start all over and again. Things are really a mess. Now, I just want to. There were so many different things that I noted in the book, and you bring up so many great quotes from Dr. King and many others. So many of them I noted and want to just keep close to my memory. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to bring up. You told one story that really got to me to the point where I want to make an apology. You were talking about feeling good outside in the woods, how you like to go out in nature.
Yes, yes.
And I know that feeling. I love being out in the woods in nature. And, you know, we're all taught so there or another with certain fears about what we should be afraid of. Especially as women, you know, we're all afraid of being raped, whatever. And I remember comedians in my circle, Jewish comedians in particular, that would make jokes about how if we saw two African-American men walking down the street, we'd be afraid. But, you know, it wouldn't happen if we saw two little Jewish guys walking down the street, because the little Jewish guys, you know, aren't strong and, you know, they can't do anything, and everybody laughs. And, you know, and I laughed. But then I realized, then you tell your story about how, you know, you were taught to be afraid of, you know, the white folks if you were alone in the woods and what they might do. And, you know, first of all, I wanted to apologize because, you know, I didn't think when I would hear these comedians, I didn't think of the other point of view. And I felt really bad about that. So I'm sorry.
Well, let me clarify it. You know, I wasn't ever taught to be afraid of white people by my parents or anybody else. I was told to be aware of the potential of violence from them. And so the woods, you know, became this place where I could possibly confront their violence. And what would I do was the question for me. So, you know, it wasn't so much an issue of fear as it is watch out for the people. There's some crazy people going out into the woods there's just some crazy people out in the world. And so I understood them to be talking about white people and white men in particular. Well, and men generally, to be quite honest.
Yes, I agree with you there. I mean, there really isn't any difference. There's crazy people out there of, you know, red, white, blue, yellow, polka dot, whatever. They're just crazy.
Right.
And sometimes, you know, sometimes they're socialized to feel like they have the authority or the right to do some pretty awful things, unfortunately.
Exactly. Right.
I feel
entitled, yes.
Entitled, that's a good word. Thank you. That's what I was groping for. I love being out in the woods, and it's a very frustrating thing to know that I can't be entirely at peace alone as a woman in the woods, although I have done some camping in Costa Rica on my own, and everybody told me I was crazy. And I was more afraid of the humans that I might interact with rather than the animals that were out there in nature.
Absolutely. You know, and it's good to be cautious and to protect oneself, but it's also, you know, it can be paralyzing. And so when you take your history and your stories with you, it can be even more paralyzing. And so the challenge for me was, and continues to be for me, is to understand that I belong everywhere on Earth. I get to roam freely, and I should be able to get to roam freely without having to worry about any harm being done to me. And so that is my birthright. But it's still to negotiate that with the realities, and that there are very, you know, frightening people out in the world today.
So how do we feel, a lot of people like to carry a gun or know that they have a gun nearby because it makes them feel safe. And in promoting nonviolence, how do we manage that or have a feeling of security without feeling a need to have that weapon as a crutch?
I think you allow yourself to feel vulnerable. And you understand that to use a weapon, you can hold the weapon as a crutch, but you're buying into a system of violence. So it's to practice on that level is to, like I said, confront your fears of death and harm, and to say, and to be willing to be powerful enough to say no, and to do that nonviolently. I don't particularly think that guns make any sense whatsoever, and I don't think there's any indication that they actually create more safety. I think the proliferation of weapons and the increase in violence speaks otherwise. I mean, most people don't know how to use guns. don't bother to learn how, you know, but they go buy one. So, you know, my thought is if you commit to nonviolence and you commit to soul power, you commit to heart power, and you stay committed to that and you follow through.
Okay, now I want to open up and talk more about Chapter 5, which encompasses my favorite subject, which is food, and the things we bring into our bodies. So that can be actual food, or it could be the toxins in the air, the emotions we take in, the thoughts that we take in, food for the soul. It's a big picture. It's all important. I wanted to say that we tend to evolve or improve in increments. And I would like to...
I didn't hear the last part of what you said because the bell rang over your voice. You said we
tend
to...
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I'm disconnecting this phone very soon because I only get the prank callers and spam callers. We tend to evolve in increments where we give women the right to vote, and then we have civil rights acts, and now we're starting to, we've allowed for gay marriage, and we're moving along, allowing people to live as they should live with freedom and rights. And it takes time to open the floodgates and allow true freedom for all. And then ultimately, I would like to think that our non-human animals will also be given respect. That comes to how... But it takes a long time and it has to work in steps, which I find really, really frustrating. But
I think it's really a matter of political consciousness. So, people have to unlearn the things that they have been taught about what it means to exercise power in this world. So we feel like we've been given nature to exploit. We believe that. Propagated that myth, and it will take quite some time to undo it. And we need to undo it sooner than later because it is a myth that has led to resource depletion, to climate change, and of course to the decimation of several species because of the choices that we made and the ideology that we have bought into. So yes, it will take some time, but we don't have much time. And mm-hmm. We don't have time to evolve. We have to actually become activated and push our government and our corporations and whoever else to make the kind of changes that we need to make. And it requires also a very different worldview and to see that we are connected to the world, that we are not masters of other species and other parts, other kinds of life on Earth.
Now, that's important, what you just said. We are not masters of other species. This is something big that we really need to figure out because we really believe that we are master, that we are better, that we're more intelligent. And as a result, right. It limits our possibilities, and it's actually devastating to us.
Yes. When Thich Nhat Hanh talks about interbeing, and that we are all made of non-human elements, that everything that's in the cosmos is required for our life and our survival. When King talks about interrelatedness, that we see ourselves in one another, that has to include the natural world. And if it doesn't, then we're really doing harm to ourselves. And I think that this just is getting played out in really awful ways on our planet. So. Yeah, and it frightens me that we want to go elsewhere and look for other, life in other parts of the universe and say, well, we're taking our ideology with us. And I don't necessarily think that will turn out well for other forms of life at this point. But
I personally believe that one of the greatest nonviolent acts that we can do is by choosing nonviolent foods at every meal. And
yes. I think we have to, everything that we do, including our eating, should be reframed in terms of nonviolence, to ask the question, what harm am I participating in? And our society is complex enough where you just simply cannot remove yourself from doing some harm, but you can become conscious of it and make very different decisions. And I think at the dinner table, we can make those kinds of decisions. And that includes thinking about, the kinds of ways we support corporations that exploit resources and harm animals and so forth.
Okay, so let me ask you what you eat. What kind of diet do you have?
I have a diet that needs to go through nonviolent training.
<I'm honest. laughs>
I mean, eat something up. I used to be a vegetarian, and then, you know, this was years and years ago. And then a light turned on for me, and I started eating meat again. And as I now become more aware of the harm that that does, and I become more invested in living a life of nonviolence, I am slowly sort of taking myself back into a vegetarian diet.
Okay, well, I like the way you frame that, nonviolent training. That's very good. I might use that. And, you know, if there's anything that I can do to help you get to a more nonviolent way of eating, I'd be happy to do that. We do that a lot at Responsible Eating Living.
I appreciate that.
And we do our very best to make plant eating not only nutritious, but delicious and fun. And but, you know, eating plants, too, can have a certain amount of violence involved. And in terms of toxic pesticides and herbicides, which we're not only putting into the earth, which gets into our water system and it gets into our food, but the poor farm workers that handle these chemicals, oftentimes not because of them, but because of the people that hire them, they don't follow the safety procedures. Women tend to have tremendous problems with birth, and their children have birth defects, and it's just a disaster what we do. Every step.
Including genetically modifying our food supply. I totally agree.
Yeah, so I'm just kind of curious. I hope you don't mind if we stay on this subject a little, because I love food.
Not at all.
but I always like to, you know, understand. We're so complex and hard to understand. But you know, how do you manage eating food that you know has come from a violent place?
That comes from where?
From a violent place, slaughtering animals that have been in factory farms, and
So for one, I try to at least buy since I buy meat, that I try to buy meat that is not raised in factory farms. And for a lot of reasons, I mean, I've seen the shows. I can't remember the name of it now. The movie that was done on factory farms and animals, and that completely opened my eyes to think of the kind of cruelty involved in producing, you know, mass-producing pork and mass-producing beef and so forth. So I try to be real conscious of where I get my food. Often I go to farmers markets, talk to the farmers themselves, and try to buy local. So paying attention to, or you know, purchasing organic foods, reading my labels to make sure that they conform to certain things, such as they're not genetically modified. I'm just kind of being really conscious and purposeful about the everyday decisions I make about the food I buy, and not, you know, purchasing items that I think might contribute to more violence in the world, and certainly not contribute to creating stress in my body and in my consciousness.
That's really an important point, because when we consume animals that have been in a very stressful situation, I haven't seen any science on this, but I believe that we're consuming those chemicals of stress and fear, and it becomes a part of us, which doesn't do us any good.
Yeah, I've heard that theory, and you know, I think it's intriguing. I'm not sure how true it is, but I think it's something to think about when we, obviously, our own body chemistry changes when we're under stress and when we're fearful. And so, you know, one has to wonder how that change in chemistry affects those who consume products, meat products and so forth.
We're hearing about so much violence all over the world. We have this horrendous Middle Eastern crisis, and not only is it just horrible with the wars and the violence going on there, but now all these people are trying to move through Europe. Nobody knows what to do with them. We have terrorism in our own country, the United States, even though somehow we don't like to call it terrorism often when some crazy things happen when somebody goes in and shoots all these people in a church. Where do we begin? Where do we begin with nonviolence? Where do we begin? There's just so much going on.
I think I've said this, may have said this earlier, but I wanted to, you know, I think we have to sort of do away entirely with the public-private split that characterizes how we do and conceive of activism. And so we can come up with, you know, so-called peaceful solutions, but if they're infused with our own violence, then those solutions will last only so long. That we have to reimagine our society from our everyday actions, and then to use that opportunity to sort of transform the structures of violence in our society. So let me just give you an example. I went to a peace rally in Hawaii when we were bombing Iraq, and at that rally, at that peace rally, I noticed a mother and child interacting, and the mother was grabbing the child by her pigtail and yanking it and talking to her, you know, in ways that were clearly angry, and then yanking it again. And I had to ask myself, okay, can those of us who are here actually bring peace, you know? And I looked around and saw other sort of evidence of, you know, non-peaceful ways of being. And then I had to think about my own investments in anger and rage and so forth, and the ways in which every day I sort of play out violence. And I had to ask myself, can I live in a society that I can create from this place? And so I think we have to do both. One is to sort of meet those crises with serious political activism, and that means confronting our government. I think that is of utmost importance, to require that our governments begin to adopt nonviolent domestic and foreign policy. But we also need to do the work ourselves.
Okay, well, you've given us a lot of food for thought today. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
And I enjoyed reading your book, and there's, as I mentioned before, a few sections in there that I'm going to continue to repeat to myself. I think we all need to do that. If there's things that we like or something that gets to us, don't put it aside. Put it out in the front somewhere where you can continue to remember it, because we're constantly bombarded with stuff, and the important stuff seems to just get lost. All right. Well, thank you for joining me on It's All About Food, and all the best with nonviolence now. Let's get it.
Thank you very much, Karen.
Okay. Take care.
Bye.